Hello everybody and welcome back to Steam and Steel, a podcast all about heritage railways. Now, a couple of announcements before we get into this episode. I apologise for the delay on this episode. Been rather busy with work, also a few other things, health issues have come up, but everything's fine. And also, I would like to move this podcast to a fortnightly podcast. Makes it easier for me to work around work, and also makes things easier for me to record people and edit everything, etc, etc. So, having all that said, let's dive straight into this episode. In this episode, I'll be interviewing Cordwyn, who has another podcast, a fantastic one which I highly recommend, called Railway Mania. So, let's get on, see what he has to say.
Hello, Cordwyn, how are you? All right?
I'm good, Matt. How are you?
I'm all good, thank you. You know, all good. There's light at the end of the tunnel, isn't there, so...
I certainly hope so. As long as it's not an oncoming train.
I see what you did there.
It's a railway themed podcast, mate.
Oh, mate, you've got me there. Fair play. Oh, fair play. Hats off to you.
And that's it now, isn't it? It's all downhill from now. Here. Yeah, sorry.
That's it. No, don't worry. Was great, that, though. What a great way to start. I love it. So, thank you so much for coming on my podcast. It really does mean quite a lot.
It's a pleasure. I've been very much enjoying listening to it recently, doing a bit of modelling. Perfect accompaniment to when you're faffing around with a scalpel and glue.
Oh, I really appreciate it. It means quite a lot. So, to crack on, then please tell everybody about yourself.
Well, you know, I love talking about myself. So sit down, relax. I think I should probably talk about the things that are actually pertinent to, you know, the subject. So my name's Corwin, aka Corbs. I run a little podcast called Railway Mania. And it's been keeping me busy for last year and a bit, I think. Been on a little bit of a hiatus, really, but looking at making a comeback this year. I'm not just trying to plug my podcast on your podcast, Matt, but that is what's happening.
No, please do. Sorry, please do.
Been into trains since time began. I think, well, I mentioned this in one of my videos, that there was train-themed wallpaper on my nursery wall. So, you know, from an early age, there was absolutely no hope for me. I was going down that path of just loving trains my whole life.
Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with it. I'm certainly in a safe place to talk about it right now. You know, an avid modeller, a model in 00 and more recently 009, and a volunteer down at Bristol Harbour Railway, on and off for, must be... Well, I mean, my earliest, I did a little blog about it. It's called bristolharbourrailway.co.uk. My earliest blog entry is like 2006, but it's really a case of being like, you know, on for a couple of years and then you go off to university and forget about it all. And then you come back a few years later and learn a bit more. But it's certainly, I think from what I've heard, Matt, your volunteer experience has been a bit more intensive, as in like you've been doing, what was it, MPD you started out as?
Yeah, MPD, and I went to cleaner. I'm now officially a cleaner. So now I learned the heavy stuff, as they say.
The fun stuff. Excellent.
The fun stuff.
It was good fun, like listening to you when you were talking to your friend who's a fireman on the line as well, and just stuff you want to do. You know, it's exciting, and it's like, oh, I want to be a fireman, and I want to fire on trains going up to Carrog and everything. But yeah, one of these days I'll get there. Bristol Harbour Railway, I'm a trainee in a lot of departments because you kind of wear a lot of hats because it's quite a small enterprise.
Oh, really?
I should probably caveat as well that my opinions are my own and not those of Bristol City Council who own the railway. So I need to just caveat that at the start. I mean, nothing controversial. I'm a very mellow person, I think. But I'd need to point that out because when you're council-owned, you have to be very, very careful. So I technically... work for the council but don't get paid any money, as all the volunteers there do. So a little bit of a different setup to a lot of railways, so it's quite interesting though.
Yeah, that is interesting. So what is your exact role in at your railway?
At the railway, the Bristol Harbour Railway, so I mean, it's not the biggest railway in the world, but it is a 5-minute cycle ride from my front door, so it's very handy for me.
Oh wow, yeah, it's quite... literally on your doorstep.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, my house backs onto the old exchange sidings, and I have a guided busway going past my house instead of big coal trains as it would have been in, you know, the 70s. But yeah, so what I do at Bristol Harbour Railway is very minor. I dabble. quite a lot. I mean, do a lot of dabbling, which is, I think that a lot of people, when they go to volunteer railways, they want to be involved in the restoration side of things. But I think, especially for a lot of younger people who are working full-time jobs, that's quite hard because weekends are generally operations based. So what I've been doing is very little in terms of restoration or upkeep or maintenance, but it's more been towards the operations side of things. Yeah. You know, you take the odd holiday where you can you know, spend a week working on restoring stuff. I think when our little Avonside Portbury was coming back into traffic, which makes you feel really old because it's coming to the end of its 10-year boiler certificate, and it was when it was just coming back into traffic that I was working on it. You know, I did a week of kind of working on it and getting to know everybody and that kind of thing. But operationally, you can train in lots of different departments. You're not locked to any one thing because the operation is so small. So it's good to have people with multiple skills. If I explain a bit about the operation that goes on down there, it might give some context to what I do. So
please do.
This is more like a museum demonstration line than a proper preserved railway and stuff. It's, as I say, in the city centre. It's right on the dockside. It's been there since the 70s. When they first started, Bristol city centre was a dump. Like, it had been, you know, trashed by the Luftwaffe. And then, you know, the decline of British industry had hit it really hard. There was a lot of abandoned space there. You have houses going for millions in the centre these days that had trees growing out of them in the 70s when, you know, the railway started down there. So it's had a real turn around in fortunes. And I think that, you know, having the museum at the heart of it has been great for the city because, you know, we've got preserved electric cranes. There used to be, you know, tens, maybe hundreds of these cranes all the way through Bristol, and now there's four. So we've got four preserved electric cranes. We've got a steam crane in the centre and the preserved tugs as well and watercraft, and then the museum itself. So the railway now operates as part of MShed Museum, although it used to be Bristol Industrial Museum. And it used to operate down the wharf side going all the way to the SS Great Britain. So you can actually see one station from the other. It's not a great distance, but it's very much in the public eye. You get a lot of passing by foot traffic, especially on lovely sunny days. And because the city centre has turned around to being like a nice place to be and a place that people want to live in, it comes with its own challenges of operating a quayside railway where you are driving full-size standard gauge trains effectively down a very long level crossing. Because it's all, you know, most of the railway is set into concrete. You have people walking all around you. You have to be on your guard at all times. Safety, obviously, is paramount. You have to keep your speed down. But it's a Y-shaped railway. So one side goes down the wharf towards SS Great Britain, and there's a little station down there. Then, so you, on an average day, you'll come out of the yard, go down to M Shed, pick up your first load of passengers, head down to SS Great Britain Halt, come back again, and then the points will be changed. And they all go down the branch line. Now, the branch line was the old goods route that went through the centre of Bristol, and it runs down the side of the River Avon. On sort of, there's a sort of river rail road, kind of all side by side down the side of the New Cut. And that route is a much longer route. It's more fenced off, so you can get up to the heady speed of 10 miles an hour down there, which on an industrial is quite fast. And then ideally you get to the end of the line by the big bonded warehouses. Now, these are like close to, if you know Bristol, you know Clifton Suspension Bridge. It's within sight of the gorge where the suspension bridge is. So it's a nice little run. You kind of go from the town to the countryside, or the edge of the countryside, at least Ashencourt Estate, and then back again. And it's propelling one way and the loco leads on the return. So when you're doing operations, we have a three passenger vehicles. The lead vehicle on the way out will be the towed brake van. Obviously, you've got a nice big veranda. Then you'll have the turbot, which is an old ballast wagon that's been converted to carry passengers. And then is a custom body mounted on a conflat, which is chained down to the wagon. So apart from the towed, everything's open to the elements. So it's very different experience for visitors. You're not, I mean, there's nothing wrong with a Mark One. Obviously, we all love Mark Ones, don't we?
Of course, we do.
A very different experience than a Mark One. You're at the mercy of the elements, which can be funny when you set off and then, you know, a sudden rainstorm kicks up, which has happened. We've actually, before to give the passengers a bit of rest, we've actually parked under the road bridge leading out of the yard just for about 5 minutes, just to give them a bit of a rest from the sideways rain that's just come in.
Oh, no.
Yeah, because, I mean, Sod's law is they'll left their brolly behind. Yeah. I mean, it's fine for the guard because, you know, you've got the roof over your head. So. But so the loco's propelling the whole way on the way out. And so you've got to watch out for, back in the day, it was an industrial area. So it wasn't too much to worry about, although you'd collect the odd, you know, car that had parked badly or just pulled out of space without looking on the buffer beam. Hopefully those days are behind us.
Hopefully. Very hopefully.
Yeah, yeah. But now there's so many people around. And it's so you really have to be careful about safety. You're basically at the lead end of something which weighs hundreds of tons. And you're going at walking pace or less than walking pace because of that. But for the kind of clientele that we get, these aren't people who generally have set out to go there on a day out. This is people who just want a train ride. So the cost is low. But the experience you get is you get to sit in the open air next to a steam engine, so the kids are happy. It's exciting for a lot of people who may be visiting from different countries. It's something they've never done before. So it's, you know, it's...
Yeah, it's certainly something I've never
done. No, exactly. So it can be a lot of fun. And you're propelling all the way down. The guard has got, ideally, a whistle, a green flag, and access to, you know, the dump valve on the... vacuum brakes, so you can destroy the vacuum instantly. You've got that on your left hand, you've got your flag on the right hand. The engine driver is under instructions not to proceed if they can't see the flag. So if you pull the flag in, they put the brakes on straight away. Likewise, you can put the brakes on as well. If you're training like I am, then generally the guard will also be in the cab with you, in the veranda with you, and he'll have his hand on the other brake valve and able to destroy the vacuum himself. I mean, ideally, if you've got a lot of staff on with you that day, you take it in turns on, you know, looking out left side, right side. You're constantly talking to each other about things that come up. You don't let yourself get too distracted. My friend said, I saw you. You were working on the train. I waved to you, but you looked so miserable. I was like, mate, I was concentrating. That's just my that's my serious face. because you feel like the weight of the train is on your shoulders when you're doing that. So it's a very unusual operation, and we're incredibly lucky to still be able to be doing it, but you need to be doing it properly. And that's why we go through a lot of training in that respect. We all have competencies we have to fulfill. And, you know, this is tied in with the normal thing about, you know, doing brake tests and axle box checks and couplings and everything else like that. And you have a fitness to run exam at the beginning of the day. That's the guarding side of things. If you're like me and you're cursed with politeness, then you generally get put on platform duty as well, selling tickets. It wouldn't be my first choice, I'll be honest with you, but I can't be rude to people intentionally. And that is a curse, because that means you're going to get put on platform duty. But the important thing is that it makes money for the railway. So it, in a way, it is one of the most important things. If you have a smiling face on the front desk, or we don't even have a desk, we actually got a bag that you put around your shoulder. You know, if you've got a smiling face, then you're more likely to come back and you're more likely to have a nice time. So I don't begrudge it at all. I love being involved in any way I can, but I think that the ultimate goal for me, and I'm sure I'm not alone in this, is engine crew. So if you demonstrate enough keenness and you're cleaning the loco before it sets out and things like that, and paying attention and stuff, you can aim to get on the footbrake crew as well. And so I think I'm possibly quite similar to yourself, although in a very different environment, going from technically a cleaner to a trainee sort of on the footplate fireman. So there's no official role structure as a cleaner in our railway, because, you know, it's just whoever turns up on the day can clean the loco. and thankfully it's a little industrial, so there's not too much loco to clean. I mean, I do not know how you get to the railway in the morning and think, oh, you know, it's a, you know, 2800 class. Oh, it's a very long boiler to clean, actually. You know, there's a lot of loco there, and there's a lot of, you know, lovely copper and brass and everything that needs cleaning. So, you know, I've only got, you know, 2 meters, 3 meters of industrial saddle tank to clean. So it's not the worst thing in the world. And like I say, it's on my doorstep, and trundle down there in the morning and just, you know, contribute and have a lovely time during the day. So that's what I've been doing lately. I mean, I've only driven one loco, and that's Portbury. I've only driven it a very short distance, but I was absolutely buzzing when I came off that.
Oh, I bet you were.
And I think that anybody will find this, and I know that a lot of your contributors to the podcast have been talking about different railways that they've gone to and been kind of experimenting and seeing who they got on with and stuff, but there's the people around you that make it what it is. So, you know, it can be the best railway in the world, but if you're not getting on well with your colleagues, then you might as well not bother. So I think that we've got a really great set of volunteers. There's a very small staff on the railway, of one, I think, one person who's a full-time member of staff, and then a lot of volunteers who help support it. And, you know, different people find their different niches, but anybody who's been instructing me has been great. Like, nobody's ever made me feel like I'm silly, or, you know, if I've made a mistake, they've explained me how to not to make the mistake again. Everybody's been very patient. And I think that even if you ask the same question twice on different days, everybody's quite understanding. You know, it doesn't automatically stick in your mind. So it's been great. And up to, you know, the COVID outbreak, I was sort of hoping that I'd be able to do a lot more weekends and get into firing quite a lot more. And I think that it'd be interesting to talk to you about firing, because you've been on the footplate quite a bit at Llangollen, haven't you?
Not massively. I've been on it a few times, don't get me wrong, but then obviously COVID happened.
I feel so like we're in similar positions. I felt like 2020 was going to be my year, as in, like, I was going to be down there every single opportunity I could, spending a lot of spare time down there, and obviously that all went out the window. I think we didn't run a single service in 2020. Very sad.
I think, yeah, we ran a couple, but then we had to stop, obviously, you know, again.
Of course, because Wales was in tougher restrictions, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, especially. Yes, it was. North was, especially.
Oh, that's sad. But, you know, necessary. So, better to be doing it in the future rather than sort of having a dodgy present, isn't it?
Agreed. Totally agree.
I mean, we don't do a lot of firing on the move, for example. You know, you'll generally build up ahead of steam before you set off. We set off every half an hour. The journey doesn't take that long. So the only bit that you'll fire on the move is when you're heading onto the branch line just to get, you know, a little bit extra on the long run down to the end of the line. Long. I say long. It's not long in comparison to other places, but I love it. Were you talking to one of your coworkers about industrials and how you can have so much fun on an industrial? Because it's not, you know, such a big lumbering heap of metal that's, you know, it takes a lot of time to heat up and everything. It can be quite fun, and you can really thrash it. Like, I mean, we've been on the harbour branch a few times, and 10 mile an hour can feel like, you know, 50.
Yes, that'll be Rich when he's on about Austin 1.
Yeah, big man in Wardour.
Great local.
It's a fair bit bigger than Portbury, I think. But, I mean, we've only got two locos, two operational locos. We've got Portbury and Henbury. They're both, you know, Henbury's only ever had one owner. It's still owned by Bristol City Council, who, you know, got it from Bristol Corporation. So there's the same owner from you. They bought it from Peckett's, went straight to work at Avonmouth Docks, and it's never really left. So Portbury is a little bit different. It worked for the War Department, working for Inland Waterways and Docks. It helped build the shipyard at Portbury, which never built a ship. And then it's now the site of Portbury Docks. So, you know, all the docks engines, they all had names from the local area. So it's quite nice. So people can say, oh, it's Portbury because worked at Portbury, or, you know, Henbury, or I know Henbury because I'm from there, or something like that. So there's a lot of local feeling about it. And the idea was that the museum would be able to represent a different loco from all the main Bristol builders. So you've got Peckett's, Avonside's, and then there's another steam loco from Fox Walker, which was a fairly short-lived company. I mean, it wasn't long-lasting. That hasn't really seen the light of day much. It's in store, but it basically went to work for the NCB in South Wales, who I would say used up the remaining life in it. And I mean, even before it was donated to Bristol Museums, it was in a bit of a state with like holes in the saddle tank and stuff like that. And so it's always been a bit of a basket case, but they're really rare. So, you know, one day maybe we'll be able to cosmetically restore it, but we need to have some sort of plan in place to how to do that. And you've a lot of the time you've got your hands full because our locomotives are playing leapfrog with one another, because one's coming out of its ticker whilst the other one's coming in, and then you have a period of overlap, and then, you know, work will need to be done on one, and you're trying to balance it all the time. So in that sense, it's kind of like, it makes you think about how, you know, pre-grouping railways or light railways might have run their locomotive fleets. Yeah, it's always the same. When you're hiring a loco, you can end up just losing money on it. I mean, some railways make it work with mostly hired motive power, but these ones are owned by the museum and they earn their own keep, effectively.
Yeah, that makes sense. That does make sense. Like the Thomas ones.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting seeing things from a council-owned perspective rather than a preserved railway society perspective, but it does give you some securities, and but also it does come with the caveat that you're not the one in charge. So you are under the bigger group of the museums, but, you know, everyone's lovely there. I mean, don't think I've ever had a single problem with another volunteer there, and I think they wouldn't be there if they didn't want to be.
No, of course not. That's always great. It's always the camaraderie that you get between people that makes a railway.
We've been having a few issues recently. So the Metro bus that I mentioned earlier, the guided busway that runs past my house, that was being built over the old formation, which involved us demolishing our, it was a halt at the end of the line to make room for it. So that all got moved around, and in the meantime the riverbank started going through some subsidence and has since collapsed into the river. So our bigger branch line has been kind of cut in half at the moment, but as I speak it's being put back together, so we're hoping for a return in the next few years, and that would be nice to just get that long run back again, because I really miss it. But as I say, my views are not those of the city council, so I am entirely at the it's up to them to fix it, but I really hope they do.
Hopefully they will in the future.
I mean, they're halfway through fixing it now. Well, I say halfway. It's a small halfway, but, you know, some way through fixing it now.
That's it. So,
well, I was going to say, I would dread it if it was a preserved society, because you're looking at, you know, millions of pounds to fix a landslip like that. So if it was up to the railway to do it, I don't think it would have been able to do it itself. So in that sense, having that protection of being part of the council and it being council property, and they have a sort of a mandate to protect it and protect the roadway alongside it, that in that sense it's a real good positive. Because, I mean, you've seen things like Severn Valley Railway. Yeah. Is it Gloucestershire Warwickshire had a terrible problem with landslips recently?
Yeah, Glas watched it, didn't they? Yeah.
You know, having to fundraise for them would just be a nightmare. And, you might never use that line again if that was the case. So, hopefully we'll get our long route back, and hopefully we'll be able to let it rip a little bit on the new cuts. Like, say, 10 miles an hour on industrial can feel like 50 miles an hour on a large loco, say.
Oh, it really can. Yeah, that's coming from experience as well.
Yeah, and you know, you're saying about, you get the rocking fore and aft motion when you're at speed. Yeah, you definitely get that. There was when the Portbury branch line reopened for goods services, they actually did a special train where Portbury, our little Avonside, was actually allowed on the main line. It was in the early 2000s. There's a video of it called Portbury to Portbury on YouTube. And you've got this tiny little Avonside 060 pulling a few Mark 1s up the gorge, and it looks amazing. But they did say, like, as soon as you get up to speed, you get that jerk feeling. It's like, great, yeah. Then you know it's a little tiny wheels, outside cylinders on the front. Great fun.
Oh, that's great stuff. So I've got to ask the question now. You know, obviously. So what is your? You said obviously that you want to be on the footplate crew. That's your thing that you really like doing. What? There must be a job that you don't like doing.
That's a good question. I think there's some task groups are quite thankless, but they're necessary. So because our railways are Y-shaped, there's a ground frame in the middle of it. And to man that ground frame, I think, if you're on duty there for quite a long period of time, that can be quite thankless. I haven't actually had to do it that much yet. But I think that everybody, it's kind of like, you don't want one person to be lumbered with that task for too long, because it will just become a big drag. So I think when it comes to be my turn on the ground frame, I think I'm not going to enjoy that as much. But at the same time, you appreciate this is part of how it all works. You know, someone has to do this and everybody has to have their turn on it if they want to do the more sort of fun, in inverted commas, stuff. So, yeah, I haven't come around to it yet. I've only done one or two turns on the ground frame, but I was under supervision then. So you've always got someone to chat to. Because if it's not obvious, Matt, I really like to talk. So once you get going, it's quite hard to get me to
really?
Stop. So, you know, do stop me if I'm going on too much. But I just...
Oh, no, not at all.
Just being on my own and not really being able to engage even with the public or with other volunteers or talk about trains, because actually that's why I really want to go down there. I want to go and talk to trains about people who like trains. Yeah.
That's it.
Exactly.
It's the reason why I do this podcast.
Precisely. So, you know, the customer facing side of things, you know, you can get the odd grouch who says it's too expensive and stuff, but generally people are quite well humoured. And I think if you don't take it personally, you know, I'm not the one who sets the prices or, you know, pays their wages. So it is, there's no need for anybody to get grouchy. I mean, we do get occasional issues with. Well, there's two main issues. Obviously, with it being basically a long level crossing, you are forever having people crossing the track in front of you. We have whistles and things like that to ask people to move out of the way. And I think it's important to maintain a good humour when you're doing that. I think the worst one is with the tow brake van, obviously you have the footboards on the side of it, is someone showing off to their mates and running and jumping onto the footboards, because you really have to get them to get off the train as soon as possible. And I think that's possibly the worst part for me, I think, is having to like be quite firm with people. I don't really like it. I mean, it's very necessary and you do have to do it, and you have to instantly react, because you cannot have people riding the footboards. And I think that is the most stressful part of the job, I think. I mean, other than possibly being the driver, because obviously you've got a lot on your mind, but I haven't done that, so not had any experience of that. But
no, that's insane. Sorry, with you saying that people actually try to jump on the footboards of a towed brake van.
I mean, I can see where they do it. You know, there's a lot of restaurants and bars around the place, and also people are just in high spirits. You know, people don't see it as dangerous. They think, you know, I've seen it in films and stuff like that. So it can just get a bit annoying. I mean, we had in the past a lot of issues with cyclists, but I think those have mostly been sorted out now, because there's been better signage for cyclists to go around the back of the museum where the tracks have been filled in, rather than around the front of the museum where the tracks are still very much in evidence. When you get people who cycle down the quayside and they get their wheels stuck in the rails, it's not good for anybody. So we tend to discourage it. It's not good for museum staff to tell them off. It doesn't look good for the museum. It doesn't look good for the person doing it. And also it's dangerous for them and other people around them. Even though they might think, oh, I'm okay, they're okay until the point they fell all over. So, I mean, I don't really like to talk about it too much, but there was a really tragic incident a few years back, and it didn't involve the train at all, but it involved the rails on the quayside, and that part of the quayside's always been unfenced, and you're not supposed to cycle down there. It's quite clear if you were to stop and look around that you're not supposed to cycle down there, but I do understand when you're cycling along, you're just bombing along. There's a chap going down there. He was not a professional cyclist, but a keen cyclist. And very early in the morning, fog in the air, very cold. And he thought, well, I'll just take a shortcut down the quayside. And unfortunately, his wheels got caught in the rail and he went into the harbour and unfortunately died. Awful business. And obviously just terrible. It's very difficult, because he'd been down there hundreds of times before. He'd always gone around the back way. He had generally been with his cycling partner. On this occasion, he didn't, and it ended in tragedy. So there have been temporary fences down there whilst a solution has tried to be worked out. But I think that the onus now is on just avoiding people going down there. So you don't want cyclists to be involved on the quayside. And I think that's better for everybody. It means the museum staff don't have to, you know, tell people off for cycling. It means that the cyclists are safer. It means the pedestrians are safer, because no one wants a cyclist going sideways at waist height. I think that the worst part of the job is having to tell people off. And you know you're doing it for their own good, but you know that, you know, it gets people's backs up. Sometimes people are embarrassed. No one likes being told off, do they? Some people get embarrassed and some people get...
No, I know what you mean.
...antsy about it, especially when they've been, you know, shown up to look a bit of a prat in front of their friends. They can get a bit bullish, but you kind of have to take it in good spirit and just know that you've done the right thing.
That's it. That's it. So I've got to move on to the next question. I don't really like to follow questions,
I'll stop talking,
but you know
at some
what
point
I mean.
And then you can get a word in edgeways.
No, don't worry. Don't worry about it. Oh, I enjoy the chat. Trust me. I enjoy the chat. So you've got to have an amusing... Have you got any amusing stories?
I can tell you a story
about
that makes me look great. Anything that's happened. Can I tell you that one? Well, so...
Go ahead. Go right ahead.
Station
please do.
We've got is down at SSGB. I was chatting to the local crew because obviously as soon as the loco stops, I'm attracted to it like a magnet. I was actually guarding that day. I was chatting to the local crew and there was a family having a look inside the loco. And at the end of, we've got a proper platform there. We've got a proper platform with, like, you know, edging stones and ramps at the end and everything. They were talking to the engine crew. Ooh. And there was just something that happened so quickly was that the pram they just left on the end of the ramp just starts rolling down the end of the ramp towards the rails. And it was,
oh no!
I sound like such an idiot saying this, but I couldn't speak. I didn't know what to say. Like, so just legged it. My big boots. Obviously, you're wearing your big steel toe cap boots and everything. Legged it, grabbed it just as it went over the end, span it round. It was empty. There's nothing in it. I was like, and so it's like, oh, no. Don't even get to save a child, for goodness' sake. But it's all this horrible moments, and it's just like, do something. Yeah. So I mean, that story is good because it makes me look great, but also an idiot. So, but I think I did the right thing.
Oh, too right. Yeah. God, you definitely did right there.
But, I mean, there's been plenty of things in the past, like when we do operations with the cranes, and there's a great event that we do called Docks Heritage Weekend, where we've actually got something that I don't think many museums have got in the UK, which is a revolving capstan, which is like a bollard that's set into the harbour side, that you know, it looks like the kind of thing that you tie ships to, but actually it rotates. In the past, I think a lot of them would have been hydraulic, but this one's electric, and the museum got it working again. What you do is you tie your wagons that you want to move down the quayside to a length of rope, and you run it around. You run the rope around the capstan, and then you put your foot on the pedal that operates it. It only rotates one way, so the way that you wind the rope around will obviously, and the way you tie the rope off on the wagons will obviously change the direction. You can put it through a pulley at the other end to change the direction of the wagons. Anyway, you wrap it around, and instead of having to haul on the rope, you just pull the rope tight around this revolving capstan, and that pulls the wagons along. So all you're doing is pulling up the tension, so the rope goes tight on it, and then the capstan pulls the wagons along for you. So you get to see that in operation at the Docks Heritage Weekends. But you also get to see the electric cranes, and they're
that's
a lot of
cool.
Fun. You're learning to direct the operator. They used to call them the operators of the cranes. They used to call them tin gods because they sit way up over everybody. Well, they stand. They stand for their entire shift. Can you imagine spending all day in one of those cranes? And also, everybody who was working on the dock side was almost under the command of the person in the crane, because if the person in the crane's slow, you don't get paid properly. You don't get to do as much work. So, and if that makes you look bad, then you're not going to get hired the next day. It's very much a gig economy back in the day. So
no, that
you
makes...
would do anything you could to make sure the crane driver was happy and make sure you were ready when he was ready. You learn to direct the cranes as part of the museum crew. You learn to strap down loads and how to rig things and things like that. And of course, you know, as the day wears on, you'll find somebody's tea mug. And then, of course, what do you do with the tea mug? You put it on the crane hook. And what does the crane driver do? Of course, he dips it in the harbour before gently setting it back on the same side full of harbour water. And whoever's mug that was learns not to leave their mug out.
Oh, nice. That's quite
that.
Grim. What kind of amusing?
And definitely wash the mug before you use it again.
Oh, definitely. So when you visit, you said you've been into trains all your life, then what's your favourite loco? Are you steam, diesel, or both?
I'd say I'm very accepting of everything, but my heart's got to be with steam. You know, I just I love diesels. I love the clattering sound of like old diesel engines and things like that. And I love the technology behind them. But there's something about steam engines. It's hard to put your finger on it without resorting to cliches. You know, like, I know that people hate it when you say, oh, it's a living, breathing machine, blah, 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 blah. They've all got their own personalities and stuff. But it definitely feels that way. And the magic, the alchemy of turning rock into fire, into propulsion, there's something magic about that. So it's elemental, isn't it? It's like, you know, water, air, fire, and earth. I guess that's the coal. and then you make movement out of it. And there's something magical about that. And I know that it's a lot of fun to dive diesels and electrics and things, but it's not the same kind of magic. And they definitely have their place. I mean, we've got a couple of diesel-powered units at Bristol Harbour Railway. One's a crane, which is extremely useful because it can move a wagon or two around on its own. And the other's a little Ruston shunter, which is stuck in the shed at the moment.
Yes.
But, you know, is it a little 165, I think it is. And that's an old Bristol engine as well. Like, it used to work at Avonmouth down the road. So, you know, they all have a history with local area. But the thing is, it's not vac-fitted, because why would we run the diesel on a visitor line? Like, when you can run steam, that's what people want to do, because there's novelty to it. For average members of the public,
yeah, there is.
I think more than most, we are dealing with people who aren't railway enthusiasts. And I know that, you know, everybody says, oh, the average member of the public doesn't care, or things like that. But I think that, you know, I don't think they'd get the same kick out of a diesel.
No, it's like when we go to, when Hangoffland runs a diesel gala, you know, or runs a diesel weekend. People, regardless of whether they're train enthusiasts or not, want to go behind a steam engine. Regardless of what it is, they just want to go behind a steam engine. It's, you know, there has been unfortunate times where people have turned up, find out that's there's really a diesel sad. Running and turned and gone. It is, but unfortunately that happens. People want to go to a railway.
I think it's the novelty of it. I do wonder what things would be like, say, for example, if you only had electrics on the main line. Like, would people be more into classic traction if that were the case? Because it would be so far removed from what they were used to. They're used to these sort of almost silent machines. And then there's these, you know, the difference between, say, what are they called, the new Hitachis, and going behind a 37, for example. Like,
yeah,
an incredible difference. And if people had more of a divide between what they were used to and what the novelty was, perhaps they'd be more inclined to go behind classic diesel traction. But there's also the argument that people will go, and I think this is becoming less and less true now, is that people remember certain things from their childhood and they become nostalgic about it and they want to see it again. I think, yes, that is true, but I didn't grow up with steam and I still love steam. So I think, I don't know how much that holds water.
Well, it depends what tenders on the back, I suppose. How much the water tanks hold.
I knew it was going that way.
Sorry, I couldn't help it. I couldn't resist that. I couldn't resist it. Me thinking, oh, I might need a paracetamol down, if I start down. Thinking.
The thing is, I'm going to be really lame. My favourite loco is Portbury, because it's the first engine I ever crewed and it's the first engine I ever drove. And I'm a big fan of it. I love the its tininess and its shape, and I just think it's a good sized engine for what it does. And it's been, you know, motoring away on Bristol Harbour side for a lot of years. I think it came back in the 80s or 90s, and it's been working on Bristol Harbour side since then. So, and Henbury, I mean, even more so, Henbury's been running steam trains on in Bristol City Centre since 78, I think. So yeah, looking forward to getting that back next year. I think the Avonside is going to hand over to the Peckett in the next couple of years, and we're going to be using the Peckett for a few years after that.
Well, it's definitely not late. Definitely not.
So just got a personal attachment to that engine.
Well, no, there's nothing wrong with it. Well, I've got a personal attachment to the standard tank.
In fact, I've got a great memory of that loco. Because we've been up to Hangoffland a few times, and very fond memories of going up and doing the ale train on the gala weekends and things like that. But I remember standing on Berwyn platform and just hearing, coming down the valley, there's a Standard 4 just hammering through the station non-stop on the goods train. Great sight. Cracking. Absolutely cracking.
And it's the first it's the first local I ever went on the foot plate of, and I've got a real soft spot for it. Yeah, so absolutely. I know exactly what you mean with that.
I think do you think many people would generally gravitate towards the first thing that they worked on?
I don't know, you know, that's a good point. I think some people like, you know, people like love the mallard because of what it represents, maybe. I don't know. That's a good question, actually.
The experience they had, if it was horrible, then maybe they didn't want to see it again. But, yeah. Well, that's the thing.
Maybe.
Because
yeah,
I've only done
a few
days.
That's a very good point.
Not as many as I would have wanted to. But generally, they've been really lovely days. It's been the middle of summer. You know, everybody's happy. Everyone goes for a drink afterwards. But what people have said to me is, like, it's going okay at the moment. But you will get to a day where everything goes wrong and it's not in your control. And it'll feel like you're doing everything wrong and you won't know why. And because that day hasn't really happened yet, I live in fear of that day. So I presume it's going to be a day when, you know, it all goes wrong.
No.
Can't steam, can't get anything to work, you know, but we'll see how I get on.
Fair play. So moving slightly off the big train, the big steam engines and trains, if you like, into the more smaller realm of things.
Bodger.
You're quite an avid modeler, aren't you?
Certainly not a proper modeler by any stretch of imagination. I love to bodge and bash and chop things up and things like that. I've been doing it I was trying to work out when I started modeling again, because, you know, it's the standard story. If you have a train set when you're little, I mean, luckily my parents are divorced, so, you know, I had two train sets. That's the best thing, you know, about
I was gonna say, I'm so glad you elaborated on saying that then.
At my dad's house. I mean, I look back and I think, God, I was spoiled. I can't believe I was so lucky. An N-gauge layout at my dad's house. I actually had one layout that was done for my, I think it might have been my fifth or my sixth birthday, and I've still got a photo of me sort of Christmas Day, sorry. I think I got it for Christmas, but, you know, big present. And my parents built it all for me and decorated it. And you know, looking back, it was probably quite basic, but it was the best thing I'd ever had at that point. And then the second layout me and my dad built up in my room after we moved house. And it was the only layout I've had yet that was fully scenic. So, because I am terrible at finishing stuff.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, great intentions. I've never finished a 00 layout.
My mum's house,
I mean, I used to have a 00 layout that ran around my bed and, you know, the absolute dream. But the problem was that I had such a vivid imagination that I would get to the track being on the baseballs and I could just imagine the rest. So nothing would ever get done. I just picture it in my mind, and all I was caring about was the trains running by. But as I've got a bit older, learned an appreciation for, you know, the scenery and things like that, I think. So when I got back into modelling, I decided that I just couldn't be bothered with actually going around having to start a layout, because I just knew I'd never finish it. So I actually bought one that I saw advertised on RMWeb. And it was such a good thing, I think, because it worked. All the electrics worked. It had point motors and everything. I didn't have stuff around that. It was already scenic, but it wasn't scenic the way I wanted it to. So I was able to change things. And that's the thing I really enjoyed, was changing the little details. Like just changing little scenes and buildings and things like that on it, rather than the big woodwork side of things, the electrical side of things. It didn't really interest me that much. But that layout has now gone to live with a friend of mine COVID hit, and you realize I'm going to be stuck in my room for however many months.
Yeah.
So the layout's got to go. Rejig my room. I got a much better working position now. And I was layoutless for quite a few months. And lately, I was offered the opportunity to take on a friend of mine's layout. So my friend Pat, James, friend of the podcast, sadly passed away last year. And he was halfway through building his sort of big layout, and I've taken that one on, and it's so big that it doesn't actually fit in my room. I can only fit half in my room at a time, but he was great at building these little scenes and scenic items and rundown buildings, the stuff I like, the grot and the grime and everything. So I've just taken possession of that, and I'm hoping to sort of finish it in a way that kind of splices what I need out of it in a way that I hope that he would approve of, if that makes sense. Yeah, but also,
it
still means I have not started a 00 layout. So, you know, I'll just continue on that path. I think I'll just keep getting secondhand layouts until the end of the days. But, yeah. So, It's 00 and 009, so that's why I'm going for this mixed gauge thing.
Yeah, that's understandable. So are you a Bachman or are you a Hornby
second-hand
fan?
Person. Nothing survives my ownership untouched. So I kind of am terrible for not really looking at things as they are, well, how they come out of the box, but thinking, well, what could I use from that? What chassis could I use that for? Or, that dome looks nice. So I'll just steal that and use that on something else. So I mean, I have no concept of the value, of resale value, sorry. That doesn't mean anything to me. I don't think my collection is... In fact, my girlfriend's parents came to stay with us once, and I've got a glass-fronted display case because I had to do something with the models. And her dad was looking at them, and he said, oh, Corwin, how much is your collection worth? And I was like, nothing. It's worthless now because I've destroyed any value I would have had. But, you know, the value that it gives to you when you're playing with something that you've worked on and you know, you've made it look how the way you wanted to. I find that gives me a lot of joy. So that's what really appeals to me. So my modeling project is not based on anything in real life. It uses elements from lots of different things, but it's a completely freelance railway. Some people might recognize it as a railway in the northwestern corner of England in between Barrow and Furness and the Isle of Man. So it's might be a familiar story to a lot of people.
I wonder where that concept is based on, and
using the lore and stuff like that that was built up around those stories and thinking, well, how can we expand on this? How can I make this feel more tangible to me and grubbier? And, you know, everything's clapped out and weathered and everything and all that grot and grime and industry that I like so much. So it's a great project. I don't think I'll do anything else really for many years because it's going to keep me busy. I mean, everybody comes up with an excuse to have another loco, don't they? So you might go, oh, what about if we just had a factory here and then they had their own locos and oh yeah, I see that kit that's made to fit the bracket chassis. I wonder how I can use that somehow. So, oh yeah, I tell you what, let's make the Docks Authority. Love they have it. Their own locos, just like at Avonmouth. So when I got an Avon side, I had to work for obviously the Docks.
Love it.
That's where they're born to work. So the 009 that I'm doing at the moment is that kind of thing, but mixed in. So there's going to be a bit of dual gauge track, which is going to be a bit of a challenge to link up. But one thing I have decided is that this layout is going to be completely battery powered radio control. I'm going to ditch track power completely. I've had enough of it. I don't want to do it anymore. So it's all radio control from now on. And in squeezing that into 009.
Ah, interesting.
I mean, you're model an N, don't you? So I don't know how you'd manage to squeeze
it. Yeah, I bet it is.
Reliably. Yeah, I think I've seen people do it with attached carriages, which carry the batteries, but I kind of think that's cheating. I think you've got to fit it in the local or not at all. So a lot of people said, why don't you just attach the batteries in the coal wagon to the back? I'm like, no, it has to be done properly. I mean, the ideal is to not have to take up loads of cab space, but I've got to make a compromise somewhere. I suppose I'm a hypocrite. So the first changing the Bachman Scarlowe, and that's one I've kind of left untouched a little bit. I've repainted it and added a few details like handrails and stuff like that. But I converted that one to radio controlled as a kind of proof of concept. And so I've got a few on my desk at the moment. Yeah. At the moment, I'm looking at a Bachman Rhenaeus and also a tiny, tiny, tiny little 3D printed, you know, the Kerr Stewart Wren class. Little 040s. I think there's one that lives at
Yes, I do.
They're one of those. I'm working out how on earth am I going to fit a battery and a receiver into this at the moment. So we'll see how we get on with that.
Interesting. Interesting. So have you got any other hobbies?
Probably a terrible scatterbrain. Since cars for a few years, I always put it how like, you know, when I became an adult, I was able to let the world know I was into trains and I could stop pretending that I liked cars. Ridiculous. But the truth is I have kind of been into my motors ever since I passed a driving test, although I started with absolutely no knowledge. And I still look back with shame on the day that I started a forum thread and saying, how do you remove wheel trims? And the answer was, you just pull them off. And I didn't know how to do that. And that's the level of mechanical knowledge that you're dealing with when I passed my driving test. So, I mean, you got to start somewhere. So, you know, I was into modifying cars for quite a few years. So it's ended up in a situation, which I think will be familiar to anybody who's been into modifying cars, is that you've broken all your cars. So they're all kind of sitting at the lockup at the moment, looking a bit forlorn. I need to do an engine change in one and a chassis change in the other. So I don't have any one complete car. So currently borrowing a van to get around in, but you know, any people find excuses to spend money on stuff, don't they? I don't know. I think I just buy more logos otherwise.
Of course they do.
I don't know where that would be.
It's a terrible thing, but
the problem is, I think that, you know, there's only so many hours in the day, so modeling and sort of railways have taken over recently, so the cars have kind of fallen behind a little bit. But I think that they'll make a return one day, but I just need to get into the right frame of mind for it. Like you say, I'm scatterbrained, so I'll just hover around between.
Yeah, I'm sure they will.
You know, so 100% take my fancy sure for a month, and then it will sit dormant for another 6 months. But yeah, yeah, yeah. I think many of us are.
I'm a bit like that, if I'm honest. I really am a bit like that myself.
Yeah, I think especially if you're someone nature, who gets keen into stuff, and you find yourself, you know, on Wikipedia at 3 a.m. looking up like details about some, I don't know, some ship disaster that happened 60 years ago. And you're like, wow, I've learned everything there is to know about ships tonight. If you're kind of that person who gets very, very hyper-focused on stuff,
yeah,
you can get a bit out of hand if you also have access to eBay at the same time.
Well, then you got the other type of people like me who just have like these random ideas. I fancy learning how to play
and
the hurdy-gurdy
tonight.
That's
the beauty
let's
of
have
the internet.
A crack at that, you
know? Yeah.
Oh, that's cracking, that is. So going back to the big railways again, which ones
you know
do you
what?
Like to visit?
I really
you know,
regret
obviously the ones
that
you
I
work
never got
out,
to go
which
to
ones
Steam
do you like
Steam Stars
visit?
Weekend at Llangollen because they looked incredible. And is that where you got the idea for the name for the podcast?
Same.
Oh, damn it.
No, it wasn't actually.
Just came to you.
I don't
came
know where.
Dream.
It just sort of.
They look cracking.
Yeah, it really did.
Lovely holidays. At Carrig Station at Llangollen, there's a campsite just next to the railway. And we. Oh,
yes,
brilliant. Yeah, well, we
my
took
dad's
the land
caravan's
there
actually there as we speak.
Apart from the first night that we tried to find it, we couldn't find it, so we slept in a lay-by, but it turned out to be around the corner. but, yeah, that's the beauty of a van. You can sleep in the back. But, you know, perfect location, because you can just hop off at the end of the day. If it's gala weekend, you're running the late ale trains, you can just hop off a few drinks, head over to the river, head over to the pub, a few drinks there. Fantastic. Good company.
That's it.
Good beers, good trains. So I think Llangollen holds a special place in my heart. I regretfully have not visited many of the major ones. I've never been to the Severn Valley. Who hasn't been to the Severn Valley? That's mad, isn't it?
Well, I'm going to let you into a little secret. I've got my first trip coming up in April.
I need to book something. I need to go there because everybody seems to have gone there apart from me, but apart from you, Matt. So that's fine. That makes me feel better. I've never been there. I've been sort of involved with the Avon Valley a little bit over the years, but mainly only in the form of making videos for their sort of social media channels every now and again. And back in the day, used to be a member of the Mid-Hants and the Geethingworth Valley, but only in terms of I was under 18, I wasn't an active volunteer.
Yeah.
But they, I think, especially the Geethingworth Valley, I think is a very special line because it was just on the doorstep of my dad's house when we used to live in Yorkshire, and it's just a lovely little line. Have you ever been up there?
That's fantastic.
It's interesting because it's really, it's one of those oldest, you know, it's one of the oldest like preserved railways, but also just the fact that it's never had any dreams of extending. And I think that a lot of railways, there's always something to extend to. You know, for Avon Valley, it's, you know, getting back to Bath. For Llangollen, it's getting to Corwen.
Yes.
You know, they've always been in this perpetual expansion cycle, whereas the Keithingworth Valley started out at that size. And I think that's interesting that when you have that, you obviously concentrate on different things. So you have things like Vintage Carriage Trust, Ingro. You know, they're a whole other organization that's based on site, but also contribute quite a lot because you can get off at one of the stations and go to a museum. And I think that by the sounds of it, Seven Valley have done that a bit with having the museum halfway down the line. So just to give some interest. But I think that's really interesting about these people have had since the 60s to develop their railway. And they've also, you just look at the facilities that people have, like carriage sheds. Like, I think that the biggest thing for preserved railways in the last 20 years has been carriage sheds, because previously they just all sat outside. You look at everywhere you look now, everyone's building carriage sheds. NYMR built one. Pontypool and Bonavon have just built one. You know, everybody's looking at it because the restoration cycles are, even on Mark 1s, are getting ridiculous now. And obviously
they really are.
Back to the Keithingworth Valley, they've got this enormous carriage shed there, a great resource, which means they can run lovely vintage trains and things like that. So it's really interesting looking at it from that perspective. When you look at somewhere that's the other end of the spectrum, like Avon Valley, which has a short running line but has big aspirations, and how a lot of their work has to take place in the open air, and how that changes the organization and what your focus is on. And it's an interesting comparison. I wouldn't want to say one is better than the other, because obviously for the volunteers and the people that travel on it, each one is as good as the other.
It's true. It's only different mainly when you go to the narrow gauge lines.
What kind of
lines?
You think like the Welsh Highland and Festiniogs?
Yes, they're going to be, you know, obviously slightly different to the standard gauge is what I mean it as.
We went on the Welsh Highland for the first time a couple of years ago, back when we did the Garrett episode on the podcast. We went up there and went on a trip, and it is enormous. I was not prepared for how long it is. One trip out and back is all day, and that's as long as you want to get. Like, I think any longer and that'll be ridiculous. But it is run. I think I'd say the way it's run is more akin to the Paignton and Dartmouth than anything else I've been on, because it's like you have a lot of gradients. You've got the biggest engines that you can get. You run long trains. You run it for a lot of tourists, and you run from one place to another place. So it was really interesting looking at it from that point of view. Almost business-like it was. But what was fantastic about the Welsh Highland was the open carriages. We actually had the opportunity to sit in the observation carriage on the way back, and I was like, I actually really enjoyed the open carriage with no windows. It's great. If you're a nerd like me and you love getting smuts in your face, fantastic. I mean, it was like rain coming in off the mountains, and it was like, brilliant. Yeah, I highly recommend it. If you go on the Welsh Highland Railway, go on the open carriage.
Great stuff.
It's the best experience.
Yes. I've actually done
standard, more standard gauge railway should have
open
carriages.
To be fair,
I mean, I would take our passenger train up to Llangollen, I think, and we would just, you know, go in the turbot open air all the way up to Corwen.
Oh, that'd be great. That'd be great fun. To be fair, really would. So, just to backtrack, and this is going to be. I want you now to plug yourself. So you said that you've got a YouTube channel and your own podcast, which is called Railway Mania.
It was originally meant to be just an audio podcast, and I thought, why not put it on YouTube as well? And then that spiraled into doing an actual YouTube channel, both called Railway Mania. I can tell you a little bit about how it came to be. So where are we looking back to now? I mean,
please go ahead.
I'm trying to think of when I started it, when the idea first came around. But at the time, there wasn't a lot of railway content in terms of podcasts. There had been a few, but a lot of them had kind of died out. There was a really, really good one that went out called Howard Benson Posts, which were actually excerpts from radio programs, but they were mainly about railways. And I really liked the way they've been produced and how it talked to different people about all sorts of things to do with railways. And I think one of the biggest inspirations was, I don't think I've achieved anywhere near how good this podcast is, but there's a podcast called Hardcore History by Dan Carlin, He's an American guy and he knows an awful lot about history. He always says he's not a historian, but he's probably the best history teacher I've ever had. And he can just get you interested in any part of history. And he does these, you know, 6 hour long podcasts. It's just the time passes. It's great accompaniment to whatever you're doing.
If you're going for a walk
or if you're modeling or working on your car or something like that, it's great. And I wanted to make something like that. I wanted to make something where it was getting knowledge and experiences across. And I thought podcasts would be great because I work in the film industry. So I make videos all day, every day. And I thought, you know what? Making audio content would be much better because I don't have to worry about the video. And then what did I do? I turned it into a YouTube channel. So I just made a rod for my own back there. But you know, the YouTube channel has a variety of stuff. It has a lot of modeling stuff on it. It has a lot to do with what I'm modeling on because, you know, people just seem to be interested in it. And that's really nice. It's really great when people take an interest in what you're doing and contribute their ideas and ask you questions about it and things like that. So what was a bit of an experiment in putting the modeling stuff on the YouTube channel actually became one of the better viewed bits of content on it. Which is, you know, I guess it's really new here or there because I think I'll get a lot of self-satisfaction out of doing the podcasts because I learn a lot in the process and I like to produce something that is hopefully not too boring. But you know, however long you can listen to my nasal voice prattle on.
No, it definitely is not.
If you've got a high tolerance for that, brilliant. You're my favorite listener. But it's interesting because when we first started putting the podcast out on the YouTube channel, I didn't put any visuals to it. And as time went on, it kind of became more of a thing to make video to go with it. And I think I'm going to rein that in a little bit because videos of that length so often was just draining. And I've been on a little bit of a hiatus last couple of months because making a lot of videos in my work and then making videos in my spare time to a timetable. So over the summer, I was doing it weekly and then I was switched to doing it every 2 weeks. And I just found the quality of the videos wasn't quite what I wanted them to be because I was rushing them. And it's like, I would rather take longer to make something I was happy with than rush something out or try and get on top of the latest trend or anything else like that. And I think I felt more easy about doing that once I'd passed the threshold for YouTube monetization. It wasn't because I wanted to make money out of it. It's because I figured that YouTube would promote videos that are monetized more than they would other ones. So I did a lot of work to get past the monetization point, including putting things out weekly. And now I feel like I can relax a little bit. I mean, I can harp on about YouTube, but I've worked in YouTube for over 10 years now. More than that, really. I mean, my company, the company I work for, has been making online videos since before YouTube existed. But so we've spent a lot of time in this area. But you've really noticed a change in the 2010s to the early 2010s in that there was an opportunity for channels to become big without making regular content because they were just getting lots of views because people were sharing it and they were generally interested in that content. And what that turned into was that new channels to grow to that size had to make content all the time. You have to make something every week or twice a week or every day. And YouTube would reward you for that. And I think that doesn't necessarily generate a very healthy mindset because it puts a lot of onus on not making a good product, but just trying to appease a machine because you end up relying on that machine. And we've worked with a lot of YouTubers in our time, and there are some who are very successful and more power to them, but there are a lot of people who are stuck in a perpetual cycle of not quite having enough views. So things cost more because they have to employ staff or they're not hitting their deadlines or they've had to quit their job to work for YouTube, or not for them, but on YouTube. And you just see people run out of ideas and get really stressed out. And a lot of people I've seen or met and worked with who've since quit and moved on to doing other things have said, it was great, but I'm so glad I left. So I think for me, one of the main things was not to let it become a job. And I think towards the end of last year, it was certainly beginning to feel like a job. And I thought, you know what? I'm just going to put it on pause and I'm going to have some time off, do some modeling for myself, and think about what I want to make next. And what I want to make next is podcasts. And so I'm hoping that this year is going to be more of a return to the podcast format, and it might not get as many views, but it'll make me happier, I think, in the long run. Exactly. Especially at the moment, you've got to have satisfaction in what you're doing.
And that's the main thing. And I'll be... Of course you have. And I'll be sure also to leave all your
every little helps, Matt,
in the description box. I mean, no, you're more than welcome, man. So all I've got to say is I've got to say
I think we could probably go on for another hour, don't you think?
Oh, it really does mean a lot to me. We probably could have.
I've been fearing your quick
but before
five
you go
so I feel
I've
like
got
I'm
three
be
quick
really
five
boring,
questions to
but
ask you.
Let's hear them, go on.
No, so question one.
Well, let me just split that question
what's
in two.
Your favorite beverage?
Are we talking alcoholic or non-alcoholic? I'm mad for tea. I mean, I will never turn down
both.
A cup of tea ever. I don't care how it's made. I don't care what you've done to it.
Nothing
as long
wrong
as
with
it's
that.
Pretty standard, I'm happy. I'm not fussy about tea at all, but and I don't think I've got a problem. I think I could quit whenever I wanted, but I flipping love tea. Survive on it at the moment. Alcoholic, I do like an ale, but not too strong. I think you got to keep it session ales are the best because you can drink more and have a better time without, I mean, between you and I can get a bit shouty. I know that might not be obvious, but I can get a little bit overexcited, for example, and maybe, you know, that's not the best mood to be in when you're a little bit tipsy. So, you know, not too strong, something nice to go with, like, again, the real ale trains, galas and real ale trains are just excellent, especially if you've got accommodation nearby, because it's just that lovely experience of just thinking, I don't have to do anything for the rest of the day. I can just chill out and watch the scenery go by being pulled by a steam engine. And also, I'm not going to name any brands because they're all different, but
yep.
I love the ones that are brewed by people on the railway and they're sold by people on the railway to benefit the railways. I love the ones that are sold on the train, like Derail Ale and, you know, all sorts of things that are all sold on the rats. They're great.
Yeah. Love it. Question two.
I don't know if you get
what's your favorite pie
in the rest of the UK, but in Bristol, there's a company called Pie Minister, and I don't know if they have any other outlets apart from in Bristol. Great company. They do really nice pies. Since I'm mostly a veggie now, I go for one called the Heidi, which is it has sweet potato in it, and sweet potato is like potato GTI. It is. I love sweet potato. Always upgrade to sweet potato every single time you can.
Yeah.
And it's a really nice hot Pie Minister pie. You can get a great deal. Well, you know, when the markets are open, you can get a great deal with getting pie, mash and gravy and peas in a takeaway pot. It's lovely.
Love it. And the third and final question.
Oh, God.
What's your favorite TV
right
show?
Now? Or of all time. I think that anybody could tell you that The Office will always have a special place in my heart because it was there when I was growing up and it just became part of our lexicon in school. You know, everyone, and we still quote it all the time. And I think that it will have to go down as my favourite, even though it's not my favourite right now, because it's not like I watch it religiously now. It's burnt into the back of my mind now because I've watched it so many times. You know, David Brent has infiltrated my mind and he'll never leave, unfortunately, because he never leaves anyway. And I think just the time it occupied in my life.
No, that's true.
You try showing people who've never seen it now, and it's just like it's not funny to them because it came out at a time when that kind of mockumentary, or no, sorry, that kind of documentary, it was basically based on Airport. I don't know if you remember the documentary Airport, but it's just like just following members of an airport around. It's that kind of documentary. And the fact that it's stuck its guns and it said, no, we're going to do it like a documentary format. And then it had so many, you know, copycats and people like that after. And lots of those are great, like, you know, Parks and Rec, brilliant. The American Office, obviously great as well. But I think the fact that it was so tedious is how I would do it, is I love about that. I love my fun stuff to be boring. Yeah.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Well,
thanks for having me, Matt.
Fantastic.
Hopefully we can do this
having
again.
You on. I cannot thank you enough for coming on. It really does mean a lot. I'm sure we will. I'm sure
thanks,
we will.
Mate, cheers.
So stay safe, take care, and I'll see you soon.
So So massive thank you to Corwin there for joining me on the show. I had a fantastic time speaking to him. We didn't realise as we'd been talking for about 3 hours before this podcast was edited. So huge, huge thank you to him. Please go and check out his on his own podcast. Anywhere you get your podcast from, you can find it. It's called Railway Mania. My next guest will be Joe Connell, who used to work at the Central Line, a fantastic heritage railway that actually run at full speed. So tune in a couple of weeks' time, and take care, everybody. Bye-bye.